Hello, I'm Steve Galluccio. This is number 0574, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0574. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Cordelia Oxley. She's the woman behind the Book Fairies. They leave books for total strangers to find. It started 3 years ago to mark International Women's Day, but it quickly grew from there.
On that day, we put 1,200 books around, and we thought there'll probably be quite a good reaction from people hunting for the books and getting excited. So I thought there would be a really short kind of novelty interest from people. Then perhaps it might die out a bit. But what actually happened from that day was this large following of people suddenly came out of the woodwork, and actually they were more excited about hiding books than about finding these books. So they then were asking, you know, how can I get the stickers? How can I be a book fairy?
Charles Cutter is the author of the mystery thriller Bare Bones, Murder at Sleeping Bear Dunes.
In this story, there's a big, very profitable cherry orchard owned by a very successful, strong woman named Helen Lockwood. And Helen has been fighting the government for 7 years with Burr Lafayette as her lawyer, and has so far managed to keep them from getting it. But she disappears. And a year later, she's found in a shallow grave on South Manitou Island, and her husband is arrested for murder. So Burr switches from being an appellate corporate lawyer, which he's most comfortable with, to yet another criminal case.
Stuart Nullman is along with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and on this edition of Book Banter, we're going to delve into the world of cybercrime and cults with Catherine McKenzie's latest crime thriller, You Can't Catch Me. So you better protect your PIN number. The action is happening soon on the Stuff File program.
And of course, there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and an idiot of the day coming up a little later on. The guests later. The person who told you this was show number 0574 was playwright Steve Galluccio, Montreal-based screenwriter and playwright with such hits as the film Mambo Italiano, based on his successful play, plus Funky Town, and also the TV series Ciao Bella. He also wrote the 2018 film Little Italy, starring Emma Roberts, Hayden Christensen, Danny Aiello in his last role before he passed away, and Andrea Martin. And he is a treasure here in Montreal. Thank you very much, Steve, for doing the guest lead on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. Police in Pennsylvania said a man who dressed as the yellow Teletubby and broke into a friend's home for leftover Chinese food has been charged with burglary. Bethlehem police said 20-year-old Lehigh University student Therese Owens Jr. was dressed as Lala, the yellow Teletubby, when he allegedly broke into a friend's house at around 2 a.m. and filled his man purse with leftover Chinese food from the refrigerator. The door to the residence was damaged during the break-in. Officers caught up with Owens, who police said was dressed up for a nearby costume party shortly after the incident, but he was released when the victim initially declined to press charges. By the way, during our trying times, shouldn't party be stricken from our vocabulary and our lifestyles? Anyway, said the Bethlehem police chief, I guess the victims thought about it and the landlord got involved with the damage, and Owens has now been charged with burglary.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh, Dipsy. Uh-oh, Po. Uh-oh, Tinky Winky.
The chief said the case was unusual for the department. Not that many Teletubbies get arrested, he said. You can't make it up.
Ooh.
Yeah, I always knew the Teletubbies were a gateway to crime. 39-year-old Daniel Albert Neha is a homeless man who resides in St. Petersburg, Florida. For nearly 2 weeks, however, Neha lived in relative luxury. He was arrested on August the 9th after a cleaning crew found razors, shaving cream containers, and blankets in a seldom clean suite at Al Lang Stadium, where the Tampa Bay Rowdies soccer team plays. Neha had been helping himself to food and Rowdies clothing valued at more than $1,000. He had also consumed $250 worth of drinks. Okay, he's homeless, the stadium is empty, the food is there. Daniel shaved, kept clean, and dressed like a fan. His chutzpah can practically get him hired as the new team mascot. During a trip to St. Augustine Beach, a married Georgia couple was arrested on charges of child neglect and drug possession. Investigators said police found meth, LSD, a gun, and pornography in the car that 31-year-old Tiffany Smith and 32-year-old Cody Smith were driving. Police also said children were in the back seat. Kimberly Hunley, Tiffany Smith's sister, said she was in disbelief when she got a call about the couple's arrest. "None of this makes any sense to me," Hunley says. "I don't like it because they're being put off as they're bad people, and they're not. They're the best parents. Sometimes they're so overprotective, it's unreal." According to the police report, an officer noticed the couple standing outside their car and that they appeared to be under the influence. Police said they noticed the children, ages 9 and 10, in the back seat with some of the collected items in plain sight. Authorities drove the girls back to Georgia, where they were placed in the care of their aunt and uncle. Folks, if on your bingo card you had meth, LSD, a gun, porn, and children, you are a winner. As for the Smiths, they are not. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Srinivas Gupta, a businessman in Kopal, India, and his wife, Madhavi, were building their dream home when she died in a tragic car accident in 2017. But in many ways, she is still with Gupta, especially now that he has installed a life-size wax statue of her in the home. Madhavi's likeness is in a seated position, clothed in a pink sari and gold jewelry. Said Anusha, one of the couple's daughters, "The planning of the house was all done by her, and we couldn't imagine entering this new house without her." At a housewarming party on August the 7th, friends and relatives posed with Madhavi on a couch and posted pictures to social media. The family says they will keep the statue in their courtyard. "She used to enjoy the outdoors," Anusha said. "Yeah, I've seen those pictures. It's a tad on the creepy side. I know she's only a wax figure, but this is just one step away from Norman Bates' basement."
"My mother, what is the phrase? She isn't quite herself today."
And let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Cordelia Oxley is the book fairy in chief behind The Book Fairies. The Book Fairies pop a sticker and some ribbon on a book, make it a little surprise gift for someone, and leave it somewhere to be discovered. The Book Fairies launched in March of 2017, and they are worldwide, with almost 9,000 people sharing books in over 100 countries. Cordelia joins us via Skype from the UK. Hi, Cordelia.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. I saw a recent story here in Canada on one of our national news broadcasts that talked about the book fairies, and I thought this was a fascinating idea, so I said I had to go back to the origin of this. How did this start for you in the UK back in March of 2017?
So it was an interesting one. International Women's Day is the 8th of March, and the plan behind it was to hide a number of books that are either written by women or with a feminist angle, in partnership with Emma Watson's book club, Our Shared Shelf. And so on that day, you know, we put 1,200 books around, and we thought there'll probably be quite a good reaction from people hunting for the books and getting excited. So I thought there would be a really short kind of novelty interest from people, and that then perhaps it might die out a bit. But what actually happened from that day was this large following of people suddenly came out of the woodwork, and actually they were more excited about hiding books than about finding these books. So they then were asking, you know, how can I get the stickers? How can I be a book fairy? So we went from a small group, a very small group of people, to, you said 9,000. I think I need to update the website. It's more like 14,000 now.
Wow.
And worldwide. And, you know, we just love those responses from people. It's all anonymous, so we don't get personally thanked, but those responses from people who send messages saying, I've just found this, I was having a horrible day, it feels like this was meant to happen, and it's really cheered me up. And it feels like a fairy has left this for me. And that just keeps us going. And then now it's 3.5 years later, and we're stronger than ever. And we celebrate all sorts of things throughout the year, as well as International Women's Day, obviously.
So exactly how does it work? Because you mentioned you have stickers.
Yeah.
What happens if, let's look at it from both sides of the coin. So the the person who is leaving the book somewhere, and also the person that's finding the book. So first, the person leaving the book, what do they have to do besides affix the sticker to the book?
So all they have to do, so I always say there's a few things you need if you want to be a book fairy. One of them is the official stickers. One of them is a pile of books that you have read or that you've got hold of that you'd like to share with others. And the other is just the drive to spread some magic and some goodness into the world. And what everyone does it slightly differently. The one kind of trend throughout is making sure the sticker is on the front of the book. And the important thing about that is that people now recognize the logo. They recognize, oh, this is a book fairy book. And you'll often hear people find it, say, oh, I've just found a book fairy book. So they really recognize that now. So the person leaving the book just pops the sticker on the front. You can get the stickers from the Book Fairy website. And they might put a little bookmark, or they might write a note inside saying what they liked about the book. We've also got some new kind of library card style stickers where you can write your thoughts on the book and where you read it and where you found it. And then they can just choose somewhere in their local neighborhood, like a bench or a sheltered area. Like, I quite like the entrances to churches because they're very picturesque. A lot of people walk past, and then you just leave it there. You can take a picture and you can post it on your social media if you like. Again, that is completely optional. And then people can see that you've left it there. But more often than not, it's just someone walking past who spots it. And the finder will discover it. There's the sticker says, take this book, read it, and leave it for the next person to enjoy. And the idea is that they do just that. But again, they can keep it for 3 years if they want. It's still another life to that book. And then when they get round to it, they'll remember that it's a book fairy book, and they can put it back out there in the world. And it doesn't even have to be local to them. You know, you can, people take them traveling, obviously not at the moment, but when they're traveling, they'll often take 10 books with them to hide in that country or in that town. So it just spreads and spreads and spreads. And often inside, people actually put the stickers inside, some unused stickers inside, so that the finder can then put it on two other books. And then it just grows and grows.
I was about to ask, do you find that the people who are the finders of the book become book fairies themselves? And do you have any idea what kind of percentage that is?
I don't have an idea of numbers because we don't do any kind of, we don't like to push the technology side of things. So it's this beautiful mix of online and offline. If people want to post they've found a book, that's fantastic. But we don't kind of pressurize people into doing that. As book fairies, we will often walk, do another loop to make sure the books have been taken. And if they haven't, we'll move them to another area. So we know they have been found. But again, you might get 3 people in 100 books saying that they found a book. But what I love is that you do see that if you do a certain campaign, for example, if we do a campaign with a publisher or with an independent author in one area, I will then see that reflected in, you know, the different locations that are ordering stickers. So it definitely does mean it leads to a rise in, you know, finders becoming book fairies themselves, because they feel like it's such a gorgeous feeling and they want to make that happen for someone else, which is, it's just so beautiful, the generosity of the fairies.
I was about to ask, because you mentioned authors, what is the situation? Do you find that it actually is a help to authors, especially if you join with them? Because again, as I said, I saw this as a story on our national news here in Canada, and there was one particular author who said that it had actually helped her book sales.
Yeah, so the great thing is we love all books, which seems really general, but we do. But we often find that we like to go for the underdogs and those authors that might not have as much of a presence as others. So, you know, even just our history, starting on International Women's Day, we were showing off books by women that people may not have read. And that's carried on throughout. So we do 4 independent author days a year. And all that means is that independent authors, if they can spare us some books, varying levels of quantities, if they can send them to fairies in their areas or even abroad, if they're happy to, on that day, we all hide those books. We tag them online. We say where people can buy them from. And we really, really shout about them. And actually, a lot of book fairies who receive the books and then hide them have discovered new genres that they would never have considered because these books aren't in shops necessarily, and therefore they're just not available to discover in any other way. So we absolutely love amplifying these stories that are otherwise hidden. And yes, it's fantastic to hear from authors who have had that positive response commercially as well, because that might mean that they are able to then spare that time to write another book if that's really their passion.
Now, we are living through some trying times with the COVID and the lockdown. Has that had any effect, either pro or con, on the book fairies?
Well, yes. So at first there was this kind of obviously tension about, oh, well, it's not that necessarily people are worried about catching something from a book, but we really didn't want to encourage people to go out when they don't need to. So we consciously really pulled back on hiding books outside, and we completely switched how we did things. So when we did campaigns with publishers, which involved new books coming out or films coming out that are based on books, we switched that completely to postal. So we made them giveaways instead, and we still shouted about the book, we still shouted about the films, and we ran giveaways online, which is something we hadn't done that much of before. And the other side of it is another thing that people started doing was doorstep book drops to people who were sheltering or shielding. And so we put out on some of our channels, you know, if someone in this area would like a book, just give us a shout. And a lot of fairies who were able to go for their daily exercise and take some books with them with the gloves on, they would just leave them on their doorstep, pop them a message saying, we left you a book, and then they'd be so delighted when they came out and got it. And then another thing that has emerged out of this, which is a much bigger event than I thought it would be, was I created the Fairy Book Swap, which is every Friday I put on our Instagram, which is Book Fairies Worldwide, I put, has anyone got a book that they're happy to send to another fairy, and where are they happy to send it to, in the post. And I thought, you know, you get a handful of people who'd be happy to, you know, pay for postage to send these books to people. But what's actually happened is we're getting hundreds every week. And we've been running this since the beginning of May. And, you know, to date, we've probably matched about 1,000 books to new readers through just the Fairy Book Swap. And it just kept that kind of energy going with the fairies as well, who feel like they couldn't go out and do their normal acts of kindness. So now they can do it in a different way across the world as well, which is even more exciting.
That's amazing. I know the website is ibelieveinbookfairies.com.
Yes.
Is that how someone can find out how they can become a book fairy if they want to?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's how you get in touch if you want to be a book fairy, if you're an author, if you're a publisher, anything like that. Mainly it's for people wanting to become book fairies. So anytime anyone orders stickers, and it's completely free delivery worldwide, anytime someone orders stickers or anything like that, it comes with a tiny little guide to being a book fairy, just to kind of get you started, just some, you know, simple bullet points to help you out at the start. But also you can reach out to your local book fairy channel and ask them how you get started. And it's honestly for everyone. It's so inclusive, this movement, and I just love that about it.
And as you said, it started because of International Women's Day, and you were talking about female authors, but it's grown more than that, right? It's not just female authors, for instance, and I would assume it's authors of all stripes and all genres.
Absolutely everything. So while we will do campaigns that highlight underdogs, like Book Fairies with Pride, for example, and we do the International Women's Day, anything like that, we'll sometimes do smaller days that highlight lesser-known authors. It's actually for everybody. And, you know, we run campaigns with Agatha Christie books just because one weekend we decide, oh, we're going to do Book Fairies and Crime. And then we do a whole weekend where we choose crime books, and that, of course, includes people like Peter James in the UK, Agatha Christie, which is pretty much worldwide, and those kind of things. And it's, you know, classics. We have Book Fairy Classics that happens every September, and we really mix it up. But again, day to day, people are hiding all sorts of books because everyone has different tastes.
Well, congratulations on what has turned out to be a fantastically worldwide situation from something that started so small. It's just it's a great story, I think. People can go to the website. It's ibelieveinbookfairies.com. Cordelia, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter. Lovely to talk to you.
Cordelia Oxley from the Book Fairies. Again, you can find their website at ibelieveinbookfairies.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0574, and you'll find links to their site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the author of Bare Bones, Murder at Sleeping Bear Dunes. And Stuart Noman is in with another edition of Book Banter. Plus, we do indeed have an Idiot of the Day. And several more Stuff File stories here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. You can find buttons for Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or iHeartRadio right on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. You know, lately, I purposely avoided doing stories about people doing battle with other people over face masks during this pandemic because, frankly, there are just too many of these stories, often involving stupid people, and at this time, they're just not funny or even mildly amusing. But I have to break my vow for this particular story. A Chinese businessman living in the United States has commissioned the priciest face mask in the world from Israeli jeweler Evel. Evel owner Isaac Levy said the 18-carat gold mask will cost $1.5 million and sparkle with 3,600 white and black diamonds. Money maybe doesn't buy everything, Levy admitted. But if it can buy a very expensive COVID-19 mask and the guy wants to wear it and walk around and get the attention, he should be happy with that. I'm happy that this mask gave us enough work for our employees to be able to provide their jobs in very challenging times like these, he added. Levy said he would not wear it himself, though. So, let me get this straight. in the United States, in a country that has one portion of the population vilifying anyone who looks remotely Asian because they believe that they are the cause of COVID-19, and another portion of the population who are suffering during these hard times with unemployment and depleted savings, a Chinese businessman living in the U.S. wants to flaunt the wearing of a $1.5 million jewel-encrusted COVID-19 mask around town to get attention. Oh, he'll get attention. I suspect he might not be able to achieve social distancing. He might discover a whole new reason for him to panic in public. Yeah. Okay, man walks into a bar and into an electric fence. It's not a joke, but rather a novel measure taken by one Cornish pub in the UK to enforce distance rules to stop the spread of COVID-19. The landlord of Star Inn in the village of St. Just, which is southwest England, has installed an electric fence in front of the bar to make sure that social distancing guidelines are followed. Said pub landlord Johnny McFadden, "If I had put a little bit of rope there, I don't think anybody would have taken this much attention as they have to an electric fence." Pubs in England were allowed to reopen on July the 4th, but must implement social distancing measures. That includes minimizing staff contact with customers and reducing the time pubgoers can spend at the bar. Although the fence is not turned on, we're not quite sure. McFadden said that the same logic that works in the nearby farms of rural Cornwall works for the local drinkers too. As long as there's a warning sign on an electric fence and you are warned about it, it's totally legal. And it's the fear factor. It works, he said. People are like sheep. Sheep keep away. People keep away. Interesting. So I guess it's all about shock and ale. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Wynn Hall of Exeter, Nebraska, might have expected to find a few beer cans or old tires at the bottom of his farm pond when he drained it for maintenance on July the 3rd. But he discovered something entirely different, an empty, broken ATM. Wynn said, "I thought, who would throw a refrigerator or stove and put it in the pond? I took a picture and zoomed in on it and thought, that looks like an ATM. When authorities arrived, they had a good idea of the source of the machine since one had been stolen recently, but the numbers didn't match up. Hall said he didn't drain the pond last year, but didn't think the ATM had been there too long. This is by far the strangest, and I was really shocked to see it," Hall said. By the way, you'd think ATM companies would put a GPS tracker in these things. I mean, ATMs are usually flooded with cash. This one was just, well, you know, flooded. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Charles Cutter refers to himself as a recovering attorney. And though he may have left the law behind, he has not left behind the courtroom drama. He's the author of mystery novels, and his latest one is now out. It's called Bare Bones, Murder at Sleeping Bear Dunes. It's the third book in the Burr Lafayette mystery series, the previous two being The Pink Pony and The Gray Drake. Charles joins us on the line from East Lansing, Michigan. Hi, Charles.
Hello, Peter. How are you today?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. Should it be of concern to people around you the fact that you write murder mysteries that take place in very scenic places? What is it about a historic, scenic national park or a place of great beauty that leads you to think murder?
You know, that's a very good question. These books have been referred to as brutal murders in beautiful places, and the settings in the book end up being characters, I think, as well as the characters themselves. And I think it makes the book more interesting for it to take place in a beautiful place that probably many people have either been to or certainly heard of.
Now, I said in the introduction that you are a recovering attorney. How long were you working as an attorney, and what made you leave?
I still pay my bar dues, but I haven't practiced law in about 30 years. I was a pretty good law student, but I really wasn't that great at practicing law. It really wasn't interesting to me, and I really felt like the firms I was with, their malpractice premiums were going to skyrocket if I practiced much longer at either one of them.
How did you get into it in the first place then? Was it a family business? Was it something?
You know, I graduated from Michigan State University in the 70s, and I really wasn't ready to start working. And I thought, well, why don't I get another degree? And I had a couple of pretty good summer jobs, and believe it or not, at that point in the late 70s, you could attend the University of Michigan Law School all in for about $3,500 a year. And I either worked construction or taught sailing in the summers, and I could pay for almost all of it. So that's what I did.
So what about writing? Obviously, this is, you're doing really well with three novels out now. This is a bit of a passion, I would assume. Was it something you always did? Was it something that you wanted to do as a profession or a career, but you thought maybe the legal profession was the safer route to go?
Well, this was after I practiced law, I worked at a big ad agency in Chicago, Hook, Cohn & Belding, and I had the raid and off accounts. And I got interested really in writing then. I owned some radio and TV stations over the years, and one of my radio stations, believe it or not, was in downtown East Lansing, about two blocks from Michigan State, and the radio station was doing terrible, and I, at lunch, I would go over to Michigan State and take courses in English and creative writing, and then that's how it started.
So you seem to, you know, luckily fall into things along the way. Let's talk about your recent book and the character that is the lead in it, Burr Lafayette. This is the third Burr Lafayette mystery series. Who is Burr Lafayette, and does he resemble either yourself or anyone you went to law school with or worked in a law firm with?
He's an amalgamation of a number of people. I'm not Burr Lafayette, although we have some of the same characteristics, but my behavior is not nearly as outrageous as his is. He's also a University of Michigan law graduate, although through a disastrous affair with one of his clients, he was head of the big litigation department in a big downtown Detroit law firm, and now he's sort of stumbling along with an appellate law practice in East Lansing. And he's a bit of a man at loose ends, and he's not a criminal lawyer, but he always seems to get dragged into these cases. And even though his personal life is a bit of a mess, he's a brilliant litigator and he never gives up. So part of the, hopefully the charm and the intrigue of the story is Burr himself. He has his constant companion is his yellow lab Zeke, who rides shotgun in his old blue Grand Wagoneer. And he is so enamored of his dog that somehow he convinced his first wife to name their son after the dog. So in the books, there's Zeke the dog and Zeke the boy.
Wow. Now, speaking of names, it's always important to go about naming your lead character in any story, especially if it's one that's going to go on for more than one novel. The fact that he's a lawyer, it wouldn't by any chance be named after a certain actor who played Perry Mason.
You know, no, he wouldn't. But that's a very good question. And one of the recent reviewers asked me or compared these books to Perry Mason. And I think there is a similarity. When I was growing up, my mother loved Perry Mason. And every week we watched Perry Mason. And at that time, it was a black and white TV, you know, with rabbit ears and one TV in the house. So if I was going to watch TV, I was watching Perry Mason. And I never really considered it, but there are some similarities. Burr Lafayette is actually Aaron Burr Lafayette, who goes way, way, way back and was related to the famous and infamous Aaron Burr.
Gotcha. When you first started writing this, the first book, did you feel that this was something that was going to be a series, an ongoing character, or was it a one-off? What was the process?
Well, it at the time, it was a one-off book, and I was so delighted to find a publisher. I was just happy to do that. And then after that, the publisher came back and said, you know, why don't you write another one of these? And I thought, oh, my God, I don't know how I'm ever going to do that. But, you know, one thing led to another, and I did. And then another thing led to another. And then there's this book, and there's another one in the works that hopefully will come out the end of the year.
So tell us about this current one, which is, again, Bare Bones, Murder at Sleeping Bear Dunes.
Well, Peter, as we talked about, they all take place in Michigan. And if you were to put your left hand in front of you, palm outward, and split your thumb out, and then split your little finger out, where your little finger is where this book takes place, right where your fingernail, the outside of your little fingernail ends, that's where Sleeping Bear Dunes is. And it is, Good Morning America called it the most beautiful place in America. There's now a wonderful national seashore there called Sleeping Bear Dunes National Seashore. But there was some controversy when it began. It was comprised of state, federal, and local land, but there were inholdings. And the Park Service decided they didn't want cottagers and farms and businesses in the middle of their park. So some people sold, but a lot didn't, and the government started to condemn them. And in this story, there's a big, very profitable cherry orchard owned by a very successful, strong woman named Helen Lockwood. And Helen has been fighting the government for 7 years with Burr Lafayette as her lawyer, and has so far managed to keep them from getting it. But she disappears. And a year later, she's found in a shallow grave on South Manitou Island, and her husband is arrested for murder. So Burr switches from being an appellate corporate lawyer, which he's most comfortable with, to yet another criminal case. And then the plot thickens from there. Helen was very successful, very strong, and very bright, and had plenty of enemies. So that's how the story goes. There's a number of actual places in the book that if somebody's from the area, they'd recognize, like the Happy Hour Tavern and the Bluebird Cafe and Stacy's. So there's plenty of local color. In all these books, there's quite a bit of courtroom drama in there, and that's really where Burr shines. And that's probably where I shine as a writer. Also, I had enough experience with that, you know, that I can write from what I know.
Well, that was about what I was about to ask. You seem to be very familiar with the area. While there's a lot to see in your state of Michigan, and it is very vast, as you continue going on with this character and books, if you continue the same theme, are you going to run out of scenic places to commit crimes?
I don't think so. There's plenty of them. The one that I'm doing now takes place in Harbor Springs in Petoskey, which is in Little Traverse Bay. I'd like to do one over on Beaver Island and then one over on Saginaw Bay. So they do tend to take place around water because Burr is a sailor. And I actually grew up on in and around sailboats. My parents had an old 34-foot wooden sailboat. So that's where I get most of my local knowledge.
Is the Michigan Tourism Board aware of you?
Well, not yet, but hopefully they'll hear your show, and you know, and they will be. You know, I'm a big, you know, I'm sure you've heard the famous saying, I'll be the last one to leave Michigan, and I'll turn the lights out when I go.
Hmm. Maybe they will change their motto for the tourism board. You know, the beauty of Michigan, it's to die for.
That's very good. That is very good. I hadn't thought of that.
The book is Bare Bones, Murder at Sleeping Bear Dunes. Charles, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Peter, thanks so much. It's always a pleasure.
Charles Cutter, author of Bare Bones, Murder at Sleeping Bear Dunes. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0574, and you'll find links to Charles's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Latitude 47 degrees 14 minutes north. Longitude 84 degrees 39 minutes west. Location Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, proving that crime does pay, here is Stuart Nauman. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter. Yeah, it does pay if you write a few best-selling books that deal with crime. And you can't say that for just anybody. There are a group of people who, you know, make crime pay in the pay, you know, by just churning out books.
Yes, either those are politicians. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Watergate ones. But on this edition of Book Banter, we have a Montreal-based writer and lawyer who does make crime pay for her in the literary way. Her name is Catherine McKenzie, and the book is called You Can't Catch Me. So let me tell you about a funny thing that happened to former reporter Jessica Williams as she was about to embark upon a well-deserved vacation in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. As she was waiting to board her flight in a bar at Newark Airport, she encounters a woman who not only shares the same name, but also the same birth date. Coincidence? Well, I don't know. But they strike up a conversation and find out they share a number of similarities and agree to hook up with each other once Jessica returns from her vacation. That's the first Jessica Williams. The other Jessica, whom she labels as Jessica 2, seals the deal by bumping their cell phones so they can automatically get each other's contact information. So that's, you think it's the end of the story, right? No, wrong. Because as Jessica returns home from Mexico, she checks her phone messages and emails, only to discover that the money in her bank account, which included a six-figure sum that was part of a settlement from her former journalistic employer, was cleaned out by several large withdrawals while she was away. And she goes to the police to file a report and hope that Jessica 2 is caught, and she can recover all the money that was stolen from her. However, the police are powerless and have no help to Jessica 1, because that type of cybercrime is low on their priority scale. So armed with only security tape footage that proves that Jessica 2 is the culprit, Jessica 1, the real Jessica Williams, decides to take matters in her own hands, not only to track down Jessica 2, but also recover all of her stolen money along with two other Jessica Williamses who suffer the same fate. And that's the premise of the new book, You Can't Catch Me, by Montreal native lawyer and six-time best-selling author, Catherine McKenzie. Now, the book combines the classic hot pursuit manhunt type of thriller while using the latest in cyberspace technology to track the trio's human target that they hope would lead to the capture of this deceptively clever cyber thief. So from the Adirondack region of New York to Philadelphia to the wilds of Wyoming, it's a cat-and-mouse game between the trio of Jessicas and the devious Jessica 2 in pursuit of justice and compensation that borders on the savage, with a cyber plot twist that will leave the reader quite breathlessly surprised. And our main Jessica Williams, you find out a little side to her that she had a difficult upbringing as a reluctant member of a religious cult called the Land of Todd, or Lot, for short, with their camp based in Scroon Lake, New York, that was filled with fanatical loyalty, parental alienation, and brutal punishments, especially in an area called the Back Forest.
Now, you said a trio of Jessicas?
Yes, because the original Jessica Williams tracked down two other Jessicas who suffered that same fate.
Wow.
So there you go. There's your trio of Jessicas.
Now, okay. Did the other two also have her birthday?
Yes.
All three Jessica Williamses, or William I, what is the plural for William?
Yeah. I say Williams.
Williamses. All three Jessica Williams have the same birth date?
Yes, but Jessica 2 is the phony Jessica Williams. It was just basically she used her cyber skills to cook up this little cyber scam.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So with plenty of nonstop race against time thrills and a ceaseless battle of wits via cyberspace, You Can't Catch Me is an action thriller that just grabs you by the throat and won't let you go until the three Jessicas bring this exercise in hot pursuit to its satisfying conclusion. And don't miss it. It makes a great balcony read.
Okay. I'm still trying to get the idea that three women have the same birth date with the same name. That's just...
Well, it's like, you know, like John Smiths. I mean, there's a lot of John Smiths, whether it be real or false.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
So, just giving a valid point, making a valid point.
Okay.
You're still mulling over this, aren't you?
Well, you know, you're the reviewer here. You said you really enjoyed the book. I take your word for it, but I find the opening of this just a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, it could be, but
and not just the idea that there are three Jessicas. I thought it was a bit of a stretch, her talking to a stranger at an airport bar in Newark and giving her information when, you know, she is obviously a very smart lady because of the background she came from.
Mm-hmm.
That to me was just suspect to begin with. But anyway. Okay.
It's a work of fiction, you know, it's entertaining. You know, you don't want to overthink it a little bit, but it's well crafted. I enjoyed the book, but you know what? I guess this is Jessica 2 was a very crafty scammer, cyber scammer.
I'm just saying that, you know, you're calling her Jessica 2. Let's call her Jessica Beta, and then the other one's Jessica Alpha. I think Jessica Alpha, obviously, she's smart enough to track down the other two Jessicas, and she's smart enough to chase this woman across North America. If she is indeed that smart, I just don't know how she easily fell for it in the first place at a Newark bar. Maybe she had a few too many drinks. I don't know.
That's possible.
Yeah.
But also, she went through a very bad situation at work.
Okay.
So she is kind of frazzled.
Okay. So the book is?
You Can't Catch Me. It's by Catherine McKenzie. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $22.
And what other books do you recommend in this genre, sir?
Well, I could easily recommend Kathy Reich books. I could, I can recommend, Patricia Cornwell books but I thought I'd recommend Mary Higgins Clark books because she was quite the mystery thriller writer and who started off like 45 years ago. So there's that. But also John Grisham, his third book, the first book that he published after this mega-success with the firm, it's called The Pelican Brief, which one lone woman investigator tries to find, you know, investigates the death of a well-known judge, only find there's something much more sinister, dark secret behind the murder of this judge. And she is hunted, you know, for going on in the pursuit of the trail of this devious murder.
Okay.
It was made into a movie with Julia Roberts and Denzel Washington.
I remember. So, okay. Again, this week's book is?
It's called You Can't Catch Me by Catherine McKenzie. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And it's $22.
And how can we catch you?
Well, you're not going to see me chasing any other Stuart Nolmans across North America, that's for sure. They're not that many to begin with. But you'll find me in the pages of the Montreal Times. You could call well, in print, obviously, and also, yes, you know, electronically, cyber-wise, at www.mtltimes.ca.
I can't even picture you in a Newark airport bar.
I was. About 20 years ago.
Okay, well, we'll leave that story for another time.
But it was actually at TGI Fridays with a bar.
Okay. Stuart Nolmans with another edition of Book Banter with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here on the Stuff File program. Thank you once again, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio, and also the other places we often mention, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and I should mention, soon to be, Amazon Music. There you go. A new place. Okay. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments, but I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you right here, right now. By the way, have you noticed that everything today on the show basically dealt with books? Just a coincidence, but sometimes that happens. Anyway, here we go. Two people were arrested after fleeing from officers in northeast Kansas and crashing into a cow and a fence. Jackson County Sheriff Tim Morse said 18-year-old Sky Joe Coversup, yes, that's his name, Sky Joe Coversup of Mayetta, Kansas, and 21-year-old Santana K. Noriega of Holton, Kansas, were both arrested after the chase. Morse said the cow that they hit with their car suffered two broken legs and was expected to be euthanized. Well, that's an utter tragedy. The chase began after a Jackson County, Kansas sheriff's deputy pulled over the Chevrolet Malibu that Coversup was driving. Coversup fled into neighboring Jefferson County until the car struck spikes that officers deployed and crashing into a farm fence, and that's when he struck the cow. Yeah. Coversup and Noriega fled on foot after the crash. Noriega was arrested quickly, and Coversup was arrested a couple of hours later. Coversup was arrested on suspicion of fleeing the police. That's an interesting charge, because suspicion of fleeing the police. They saw him run away. They know who he is. Isn't that just more than suspicion? Isn't that just simply fleeing police? Anyway, as I said, he was arrested on suspicion of fleeing police, driving on a suspended license, because in these stories they always do, reckless driving, and several other charges. I'm sure hitting the cow could be charged as a moving violation. I'm sorry. Noriega was charged with possessing methamphetamine and marijuana. You know, you're just asking for trouble if your last name is Coversup. The only possible way that name could do you any justice is if you're the heir to a cosmetics fortune. Anyway, it's that moment you've all been waiting for, boys and girls. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
I should let you know right off the bat that there is a picture of this guy on the Stuff File fan page on Facebook that you just have to see as I explain this story. Shin Tae-il is a popular online gamer. The South Korean, known as the Angry Korean Gamer, was live streaming a competition playing Fall Guys when a fan suggested that if he didn't win the current round, Tae-il should light his manhood on fire. For some reason, he agreed to do so for 5 seconds. When he lost, he disappeared off camera for a bit, then came back only in his underwear. He squirted some lighter fluid down his pants and lit it, but in a panic, slapped the flames out in just 3 seconds. Okay, let me stop here for a second, okay? One of my earliest childhood memories was when I was about 4 years old. I touched the bottom of the hot iron that my mother had standing up on the ironing board. I still remember how that felt, and as my mother pointed out in all of her warmth, well, that will teach you not to do that again. And cold as that was on a very hot point, she was right. I bring up that story as we take you back to South Korea because after Tae-il played Panic Patty Cake on his crotch to snuff out Jim and the twins after they were aflame for 3 seconds, he added more lighter fluid and tried again to meet the 5-second obligation, but the combination was just too much. He put the flames out again, but not before suffering second-degree burns, which sent him to the hospital. Now, I know he's called the angry Korean gamer, but if you thought he was angry before, well, but no matter how angry he is, he needs a new moniker because why, oh why, would you, in losing a bet, set your penis on fire and create your own personal dry roasted nuts not once, but twice? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0574. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0574. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, God. I always screw it up.